Hi, I'm John Mooney and welcome to The Dark State. This podcast was broadcast in the aftermath of Private Sean Rooney's murder in South Lebanon. But some of the show's subscribers asked that it be made available on your podcast catcher to give you a better insight into the threat which Hezbollah now poses to members of our defence forces who are serving with UNIFIL in Lebanon. We do hope this show goes some way to explaining the complex political environment in which this awful murder took place. Don't forget, if you wish to support the work of The Dark State, please do subscribe on Patreon or Apple Podcasts. In any event, we do hope you learned something from this show. Ireland is mourning the loss of Private Sean Rooney, the Irish peacekeeper who was shot dead in Lebanon last week. His murder is being blamed on Hezbollah, the Iranian-backed Shia group that controls much of southern Lebanon. I am joined on the line by Haneen Gadhar of the Washington Institute. Haneen is considered one of the world's foremost authorities on Hezbollah. I'm John Mooney and welcome to The Dark State. To the show. Could you tell the listeners a little bit about your career and your work at the Washington Institute? How did you end up there?
Sure. So I am the senior fellow at the Washington Institute. I've been here for 6 years. I work on Shia politics, specifically Hezbollah, but other Shia militias in the region, Iran's foreign imprint in the region, and everything that where Iran is, basically. And I work on Lebanon per se because I'm Lebanese and I'm very much an expert on Lebanon's other matters as well. So I've been doing this for the Washington Institute for 6 years. Before that, I was the editor of Now Lebanon in Lebanon, in Beirut. I was based in Beirut before coming here. So I was a journalist for many, many years before I moved to policy and policy research. Before Washington, I lived all my life in Lebanon, in Beirut as an adult, but also my childhood was in the south of Lebanon, in a town called Ghazir between Sidon and the Tyr. It's exactly where the troublemakers are. So I can go on and on about that, but this is the summary, if you want, of my career.
Okay, people will have heard about Hezbollah, but could you explain what it is and what it seeks to achieve?
Of course. It's not easy to summarize Hezbollah because I've been working on it for a very, very long time. But if I want to say it in a few words, Hezbollah started in Lebanon as an Iran proxy, as it was created. When I say Iran, it's the Iranian Islamic regime, the Islamic Revolutionary Guards per se, and the Quds Force, which is the regional army of the Iranian regime. So they were funded, organized, created basically by the Iranian regime in Lebanon in order to protect and pursue Iran's interests in the region. They are also Iran's right hand in the region when it comes to Iran's other proxies, basically the Shia militias in Iraq, in Yemen, the Houthis, and in Syria. Hezbollah is not really a Lebanese resistance movement as they started. They started this in order to get popular support in Lebanon. Their popular support in Lebanon was based on the image of resistance, freeing and liberating the land. Another popular pillar of their popular support is, providing or replacing the Lebanese government within Shia community, their constituency, and providing jobs and services. And of course, the Shia identity. The Shia is basically part of the Muslims that is basically spread in Lebanon, Iraq, and Iran. This is where the majority of the of that kind of the Shia is. Hezbollah have sworn allegiance to the that part of the Shia sect, which is in Iran, and they follow the Iranian Wilayat al-Faqih and the IRGC interests to protect their interests and steps. Today, Hezbollah is the authority in Lebanon. No one can do anything without Hezbollah's blessing or orders. The state institutions in general, except for a few pockets here and there, are controlled by Hezbollah and by the default Iranian regime. Their way of policy and communicating and negotiating has always been violent. So today, for the Lebanese people, although Hezbollah hasn't really killed a foreigner in Lebanon for a very long time, but they have a very long record of assassinating or using violence against foreign forces in Lebanon. One of the main, with the UNIFIL, of course, we know that not long time ago there have UNIFIL forces have been Spanish UNIFIL. UNIFIL forces, six Spanish soldiers have been killed before, and Hezbollah's fingerprints were all over it. But even before that, they are very famous for using violence against many other Europeans and Americans. The French have experiences with them, and the American embassy in Lebanon that was bombed long time ago in the 80s also is a very good example of how they negotiate via violence. So they are a violent group. They are a terrorist group. They are designated terrorist group by the Americans and the Europeans and many Arab states, because basically they use terrorism and violence to impose policy and interests of the Iranian regime in Lebanon and the region. And they will use violence again. It's not the first time, and it's not going to be the last time. They intimidate their opponents locally and internationally. I have personally been intimidated and threatened many times by them. That's why I left Lebanon. And they will do it again and again until they reach what they need. They're not diplomats. They're a military organization.
So I've often heard them described as a state within a state in Lebanon. So this is a highly complicated picture. Effectively, whilst they would purport to represent the people of Lebanon, really they're are trying to build a country that resembles Iran and that is aligned to Iran. But do you mind me asking, is that a puppet for Iran, or is it simply that they share the same sort of maybe religious outlook?
They're between these two. Like, they're definitely not partners, because Iran's orders come first. Hezbollah was created by Iran. It's Iran's baby. It's Iran's most proud, the pride of Iran, if you want, the most successful story of the Iranian regime. It was created by Iran. It was funded, has always been funded by Iran. So they don't, they're like employees, but more than, but let's say senior employees. So for example, Hezbollah knows Lebanon and Syria and that part of the region more than the Iranian regime do. So the Iranian regime rely on their leadership in order to give advice and to tell them what they should do as an advisor, right? But at the end of the day, they are an advisor. They're not the boss. They're not partners. At the end of the day, the main decisions reside in Iran, in Tehran. So they're not partners. They're kind of a senior employee where they have some kind of, you know, maneuver in when it comes to decision making and big security operations, but they're not the decision makers in Lebanon and Syria and anywhere they are. So it's mostly they are, I would describe them as one big military branch of the IRGC.
I see. And they have some political support from Syria as well. Hezbollah have got involved in the Syrian conflict also. What is the nature of that relationship?
They do not have support from the Syrians. They have a deal with the Syrian regime, which is the Assad regime. The Assad regime was about to fall if it wasn't for the Iranians and the Russians. So basically, today, the Assad regime still survives because the Iranians sent Hezbollah and the Russians provided air support. That's basically why the Assad regime still survives. But when it comes to the Syrian people, of course, you know, like the whole idea that they revolted against this regime has been killed by the Iranians and the Russians and the Syrian regime. So they do not, they have a deal. The deal is basically the Syrian regime will survive But the Iranians and the Russians, because they helped them survive, they will have a big say in Syria. So the Russians now have a lot of deals over resources in Syria, the maritime gas, the electricity, energy stuff. And Iran has also like certain deals in Syria, and the Syrian regime will have to pay back abundantly. When it comes to the region, it's the support that when I say the state within the state, I think what happens is that Hezbollah started as a state within the state. So they started with their own social services, their own economy, their own military, their own institutions, their own banks, their own, like a little state within the Lebanese state where they can tell the Shia community, their constituency, that eventually you don't need to be citizens in Lebanon state. You can be part of my state. I will protect you. I will provide for you. I will be your government. But in return, you have to swear allegiance to my state, not to the Lebanese state, which means you have to be Shia citizens, not Lebanese citizens, which basically means that you have to be more loyal to Iran than Lebanon. And that worked because a lot of Shia actually liked this idea because they benefited from Hezbollah's state more than they benefited from the Lebanese state. The problem is that this state, which was within a state, became monstrous and became big and became actually the authority. So now Lebanon is a small state within Hezbollah's state. Now the way we see it in Lebanon is that Iran is actually occupying Lebanon via proxy, which is Hezbollah, and Lebanon's state is shrank within the bigger state, which is Hezbollah's state. And Hezbollah's state became a monster that is controlling everything. This came with a price. They have more control, but also there is now a lot of people who see them as an occupying force, not as an actual state that protects its citizens. So they control everything without any socioeconomic vision for Lebanon. That's why Lebanon is falling apart. That's why there's a major, unprecedented economic and financial and social crisis in Lebanon. Because when Hezbollah took over, when Hezbollah became the authority, people started to realize that they only have a military and security plan, not a socioeconomic plan. And that's not going to work. So now the opposition against that state is becoming bigger, and the interest in bringing back the Lebanese state is becoming an issue, because now even the Shia who gave themselves the Hezbollah state do not want to be there anymore because the price is too high. And now they're realizing that selling their soul to Iran in that sense, is the price is much higher. They benefited for so long from it, but now they have to pay the price and they don't like it.
And this might sound like a silly question or a naive question. Do they have the same sort of religious ideals attached to them as, say, the Iranian regime? We've seen this persecution of women, the denial of rights, freedom of speech, etc. Are Hezbollah the same as that?
They are intrinsically the same. They have the same ideology. They support the Iranian regime with everything they're doing. However, Lebanon is not Iran. There are many Christians in Lebanon. The Shia are not the majority. The Sunnis are not majority. No sect is really the majority in Lebanon. And that kind of a diversity in Lebanon makes it very hard for anyone to impose their ideology. So they kind of put their Islamic State ideology on the shelf. They did not let it go. It's still part of their mission statement. But they put it on the shelf on the sense that, let's be realistic, Lebanon is not going to accept the Islamic ideology, that kind of Islamic ideology. But we will get there when we get there. For now, Lebanon is the priority in Lebanon is to control the political and security and military decision-making, to make Lebanon's state institutions under our control, and the social issues will come later. So you don't, women in Lebanon, even within the Shia community, do not have to wear the veil or be, like ideologically prescribed to Iran. 20% of the Shia, I would say, are because they want to. But the rest of the Shia community are not. Even the religious people, they're more like Iraqi and, like traditional Lebanese religious ideology, you know, like in the Shia have to follow a certain religious figure, right? Mm. Who has, you know, in Iran, Hezbollah made sure that a lot of these people follow Khamenei and Khomeini's ideology. However, a large part of the Shia community, and now it's becoming larger and larger, still have their fellowship in Iraq, which is the Najaf school of thought, Shia school of thought. And some follow Fadlallah, who's the only Lebanese who has his own, you know, like authority, religious authority. He died, but his legacy still lives on. So this is basically the difference among the Shia when it comes to religious and ideological following. 20% of the Shia, I would say, follow Hezbollah and Iran's ideology. The rest are divided between Najaf, between atheism, between leftist groups. You know, the Shia are much more diverse than one would think. It's really those 20% that are around Hezbollah who are the loudest, and the more militarized. So you see them and their presence more than the others, but the silent majority of the Shia is actually not with Hezbollah.
I see. So it's a very complicated picture, but it's probably like most countries in the world. People get on with their lives, they look after their families, they're concerned about healthcare, education, and all these other issues. And then you have this kind of minority that are maybe ideologically driven, and they make a lot of noise. So yeah. We're obviously having this discussion in the context of Private Sean Rooney's murder in southern Lebanon. And we discussed this actually last week for a story I wrote for the Sunday Times. I was really interested in your analysis of this because I believe it was correct in your assessment of these issues come highly regarded by many people in the international community. Could you provide the listeners with your assessment of this killing and contextualize it as to what probably or most likely happened?
Definitely. What happened, I think, today... This is not the first time Hezbollah wants to send a message via the UNIFIL, right? They have a problem, of course, in August. We know that there's a new addition that happened when the United Nations Security Council met and renewed the UNIFIL mandate. There was one item that was added or retraded that by the Security Council, which gave the UNIFIL the freedom and the right to do their patrols and go around without taking any permission from the Lebanese side. They basically said that the UNIFIL does not need any permission to do their job, and also they do not have to announce it if they want to go around doing patrols. This is something that Hezbollah was very, very angry about. And the if you see the Hezbollah official statements, especially those who are closer to Iran than the rest, the representative actually of the Iranian regime of Khamenei in Lebanon made a statement later in the summer, actually, between... 2 months after, or like 1 month after the Security Council meeting, accusing the UNIFIL of being occupying forces in Lebanon, and he encouraged the people, to deal with the UNIFIL as if they are an occupying force. And then many Hezbollah officials came out and criticized the UNIFIL for being spies for Israel and the Mossad and all these people, which is, you know, like the usual, the regular Lebanese people in the South, they know that this is not true. But Hezbollah is trying to paint the picture, a new picture of the UNIFIL, that they are the enemy. They are becoming real enemy. Like when you say they're agents of the Mossad, and when you say that they are occupying forces for people's collective memory, it says this is something that we need to resist, right? This is what they're saying. And how do you resist in Lebanon usually? Like you use violence. So that's basically, whether they did it themselves or not, I think they have to be held accountable, because they started this aggressive narrative against the UNIFIL later in the summer, right after the Security Council meeting. Every week you would see something by a Hezbollah official, Hezbollah propaganda on Twitter or social media, and they have like social media army all about the UNIFIL and how the UNIFIL is going to, you know, like is the enemy that is working against the Lebanese people and for Israel. It has become really Asian. So I hold them accountable for whether they did it themselves, they pulled the trigger or not, they are accountable. They have to be held accountable for the death of the Irish soldier. Rooney was killed, whether they pulled the trigger or not, but they are responsible because they started this aggressive narrative against the Eidhol. This is one part. The other part is that they've always negotiated through violence. This is not the first time and not the last time. When they want to send messages, they always use the UNIFIL. The UNIFIL is the easiest and more accessible target of Hezbollah. They don't need to go far. They're here in the south of Lebanon, next to them, doing their patrols. It's an easy target. And now everybody thinks in Lebanon that the UNIFIL, they have like more than 10,000 soldiers in Lebanon from 48 nationalities that are hostages to Hezbollah today. They can do whatever they want with them if they were not held accountable. Without accountability today, more of this is going to happen. And now, because they need to send certain messages to the Europeans, to the international community, because things are changing for them and for the Iranians, especially if you look at what's happening in Iran. The Americans understand, and even the American president yesterday said that the negotiations over the nuclear project program in Iran are basically dead. He said that like this is gone, this is not going to happen. So when you say that, if the Americans are basically admitting that diplomatic relations with the Iranians are over, negotiations are not going to happen, things are shifting. In Europe, things are shifting. The public opinion is looking at Iran in a very, very different way. The Iranians are in a very difficult position today with the protests going on. The public opinion inside and outside are changing. And at one point, they feel that this shift is, it's been months. And it's not just like any protest that happened in the past that was crushed and people went home. There's no coming back from this. And they realize this. And when they realize that there's no coming back from this, this is an existential issue. So where do they send their message? What is the best way to send a message to the international community, especially to Europe, who still has not gone full blast sanctions over, Iran and Hezbollah and others in Lebanon? The best way to send this is send a message is Hezbollah, which is the strongest, and the UNIFIL, because they're basically hostages. So I think there are many messages out of this. One is a message to Europe that you gotta be careful. Two, a message to the French, per se, because the French are in charge of Lebanon when it comes to Europe. Macron, who was supposed to come and spend Christmas with the French UNIFIL soldiers, canceled his trip after this murder. So the message was received. And then, of course, it's a message, internal message, saying basically that Hezbollah is still in control. Whoever is going to come as a president, whether it's the army commander or whoever is in charge, if they don't deal with this the way we want them to deal with that, they're not going to become president. And this is also a message for everyone in Lebanon. If you really think the army commander is not going to do anything about it, he's not a good president, so no one should support him. So it's a really dilemma for everyone inside Lebanon, in Europe, and the international community, how to deal with this. And I really think that if this is not dealt with properly in terms of holding Hezbollah responsible for instigating hate against the UNIFIL and also for killing, they will do it again. And this is not going to end well. And even if it's not for the UNIFIL, it will, every single foreigner in Lebanon is a hostage today, because they obviously went back, are going back to this kind of violence.
So effectively, this is power projection by Hezbollah. A number of people have suggested to me that they may have been through proxies, and a number of people have said to me that when you hear of villagers in South Lebanon carrying out an attack, it is actually members of Hezbollah, but that they possibly went too far and actually killed Private Rooney, that this may have been something that started out as an attack to drive away UN peacekeepers from their particular areas of operations, but it just got out of hand, and these things can happen.
No, Hezbollah is too organized to make mistakes like this. Like, this guy was not killed in an accident, right? It's not like people were angry and they, like, somebody hit him by mistake. There was either someone who entered the car and hit him, so it was very deliberate, or it was the 27 shots that eventually, you know, got to him, but that also is not just a mistake. I can't see this as, you know, a mistake that went too far. They wanted to kill someone. You know, like it's like when you go into the tank, or if you shoot 27 shots at a tank, it means you're really trying to kill someone. It's not a mistake. A mistake would be, you know, like you hit someone on the head because you're angry, and then you hit them at the spot where like it kills them. You know, a mistake is not like really shooting at a tank or going inside. This is deliberate. And they haven't killed anyone before by mistake.
I see. That's a really interesting point.
Every time they kill someone, it's deliberate. They want to.
So what you're basically stating is that this murder took place in a very, very confused and volatile political environment, that it's not just events on the ground in Lebanon, but it's issues got to do with geopolitics, it's got to do with the changing international approach to Iran, it's got to do with pressure that is on Hezbollah to assert itself as the dominant force over indeed the Lebanese government, etc. So there's lots of different variables and issues concerning
many. And if you think about the context as well, what was happening the same day of this incident, the same day, Hezbollah's allegedly green environmental organization, which is not really an environmental organization, it's part of the military service. It's called the Green Borders. They were on the borders of Israel in a town called Rmesh, which is a Christian town in the south of Lebanon, very, you know, like beautiful green town. And the same day this happened, they went there and they took over private properties and kicked people out of their land in order to control the border. What has changed since 2006 that makes you realize that you need that part of the border? Something is happening, right? I believe that they are entrenching themselves. And now that the maritime border agreement with Israel is done and no one's looking at them, you know, like it's like the tension before the agreement was so high and they were very busy trying to figure out if there was a war or not. But now that the war scenario is put on the shelf, now it is time to entrench and expand and strengthen your presence. So they are doing this now, and they are changing a lot of their positions and changing a lot of their operations and entrenching themselves in different places against the border. And they definitely do not want the UN to follow that and report that. So that's another part of the context as well that I think is very relevant. And the, you know, like it's a two birds in one stone, you know, like Iran can send a message to Europe and they can send a message to the UN at the same time.
A lot of people have suggested that Hezbollah is actually preparing the ground in southern Lebanon for a possible offensive against Israel. Mm-hmm. And I think Israel has stated this on a number of occasions as well, insofar as they're using this period to reorganize themselves, to possibly develop new types of weapons, to use it to store arms, to train themselves, etc. What is your opinion on that?
That's exactly what they're doing. They know that the war is coming. It has been definitely postponed for a while because the maritime border agreement, they didn't want to have a war over the maritime border agreement. When is the next war going to happen? I think the next war will happen. They will be involved in a war when it's like an existential big reason for them to be involved in a war. They're not going to go into a war for the maritime border agreement. It's too small. Iran is not concerned with it. They will only go to war when Iran needs them to go to war, when Iran thinks it's a good idea to go to war. And if the Iranian regime feels that they are too cornered and at the tipping point, which is not there not yet, they will actually use Hezbollah in Lebanon to protect themselves. They've done it before, and they will do it again. They will definitely use their Quds force in the whole of the region, which is Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen, in order to protect themselves. They're not there yet. They're not at the tipping point. The Iranian regime hasn't fallen yet, but they're afraid. They're worried that this can go out of proportions. So Hezbollah needs to entrench itself to be ready, and that's what they're doing today. They're trying to prepare the ground.
What does this all mean for Ireland and its participation in UNIFIL? And just for the listeners that maybe don't know, UNIFIL is United Nations Interim Force in Lebanon, which is there to monitor and hold the peace.
Well, this is a question for you, I guess, not for me. But I'm sure there are a lot of questions here, whether the, not just Ireland, you know, like many countries now are questioning this kind of participation because, as I said, the everybody feels that they are hostages for whatever Hezbollah or like the people, quote unquote, want to do. It's either, I think the only, there are like two solutions to this, right? Either you really hold them accountable and the perpetrators will have to be punished because Hezbollah will try to, you know, protect the perpetrators. They will never, when someone is not arrested a week later, then it's Hezbollah. Like every time Hezbollah is involved in a crime, it means you will never catch the perpetrator. When Hezbollah is not involved in a crime, the perpetrator is caught the next day. That's how it works in Lebanon. So a week later and we haven't seen, how long has it been? 5-6 days and no one has been arrested, although we know who they are, then that means it's Hezbollah. And it's they're being protected. So Hezbollah is going to do everything they can to make this like slip. And I think that's a mistake if no one is held accountable. If no one's going to be held accountable, then, you know, like either you have to work with other Europeans to see what's the best way to protect your people.
This is obviously leading to a big debate now in Ireland. It's been 20 years since we had an Irish peacekeeper killed out there. But Ireland has a very long and proud tradition of involvement in Lebanon, and we would like to think a good involvement and a positive involvement in Lebanon. On that note, could you maybe explain to the listeners what the normal people in Lebanon think of Irish peacekeepers? I understand, I've never been there, but I understand they're held in quite high regard because
they love them. Are you kidding? They love them. The Irish soldiers are the nicest, one of the nicest, I have to say. Really nice people, really like been very great to the people, and people love them. If you go to the south, you know, Shia areas where the UNIFIL is based in general, in the UNIFIL is liked by the people. They treat them very well. They, you know, there's a very special relationship between the people in the south and the UNIFIL. They know that they're there to protect them. They like the fact that the UNIFIL is there to protect them. But, you know, like those who are attacking the UNIFIL, this is not the regular people of the south. This is a Hezbollah member slash supporter hired by the terrorist group in order to do this. The regular man and woman and child of the south are very, very, very friendly with the UNIFIL. They have special relationship, and especially with the Irish, you know, like they're very kind. And I hear all the time from people in the south how they, you know, like have special relationship with the Irish soldiers. So it'd be really sad if this was going to end because Hezbollah decided I would be very sad actually if I see that the conclusion of this is a withdrawal of the UNIFIL, of the Irish of the UNIFIL. It would be a sad solution because they would be giving Hezbollah exactly what they need. We need the UNIFIL to go out, and if you go out, it means that Hezbollah would be very happy. Instead, I think you should be held accountable, and really held accountable. And because eventually, if they're not contained in Lebanon, they will never be contained anywhere else. They've done terrorist actions and operations all over Europe. It's not like contained to Lebanon. Hezbollah will never be contained to Lebanon. Their terrorist operations have reached many European countries, including Cyprus, Belgium, France, you name it. So either they're contained now or they will never be contained and will follow you everywhere.
Amy, just finally, before we conclude, do you have any sense of what the future holds with all of this? I mean, you're painting a very bleak picture of Lebanon, which is, I understand, a very beautiful country and should not be in this position that it finds itself in. But when you think about the future, when you kind of think of maybe in a decade or two, and, you know, young people who are maybe growing up there, what type of Lebanon do you see? Do you see this Hezbollah group eventually assuming full control of Lebanon, or do you see some sort of response by the Lebanese people against them? Because what you're describing to me is a political movement, terrorist movement, that has acquired a degree of power that far outstrips its political support on the ground. But I'm just interested to know, if matters have reached a stage now where they could possibly bring Lebanon into some type of overt war against Israel, what is likely to happen? I know it's a very depressing subject on Christmas week to discuss, but it's a legitimate question nonetheless.
Yes, absolutely. No, it's the main question. So listen, I think there are many scenarios. It depends on what happens in Iran, right? Because at the end of the day, what happens in Iran will impact Lebanon and the rest of the region when Iran is very active. So I think on the short term, it's going to be very bleak in the sense that Hezbollah will control more and more Lebanon, and the scenario of war is very, very legitimate. And I think the Iranians and Hezbollah and Lebanon will go for war against Israel and the rest eventually when the Iranian regime reaches a tipping point. But that's like the bleakness that is going to eventually, hopefully, lead to a better situation, because if they use all these mechanisms to defend themselves, I think it will backfire, because one, the Israelis and everyone else are ready for this war and they're stronger at this point. And if you see the advancement of weapons and military tactics and strategies between Hezbollah and Iran on one hand and Israel on the other hand since 2006, there is really there's a huge gap. The Israelis are much, much more ready for this war. So they will use Lebanon eventually to, you know, tell the international community that they're not going to go down quiet, but they will go down eventually. Because I really don't see the Iranian regime coming back from this. I don't really see the Iranian regime lasting more than this. This regime has already served its purpose. The people in Iran and in Lebanon and in Iraq and in Syria do not want them anymore. It's going to take a while for this to change, but it's growing. It's a snowball that is just growing and growing every day. And the protests are happening more frequently. And I think in Iran, the tipping point might be when Khamenei dies. And he's old, he's not well, he has cancer. Eventually, sooner or later, he will die. And this is probably would be, you know, the tipping point for the Iranians to increase their protests and their political collectiveness. And this will impact Hezbollah, definitely will impact Hezbollah in Lebanon. Meanwhile, Hezbollah in Lebanon will have more control, but their popularity is dwindling every day because they have shown everyone that they don't really care about anyone. They protected in 2019 protests in Lebanon. They defended the corrupt political class against the protesters, and that was the end of them in terms of internal support. So they're becoming the authority that no one likes, and this also has a timeline and a timetable, and it's not going to end well for them. I see it as they're getting stronger, but this is not going to last for long. There's like no way this regime in Iran or in the region can last with so much hate against it.
Is there a danger, though, that they will replicate kind of Iran in Lebanon in terms of just literally you crush the people, though, in terms of they've shown themselves to be a very durable terrorist organization?
Yeah, they will crush people. They already killed many people. They've killed a few of my friends. If I were still in Lebanon, I'd be dead now, definitely. They use the state institutions in order to, you know, like, put people in prison. Many people are in prison because of their opposition. They will do that. But again, like, the more they do that, they know the more they do that, they will become more of an authoritarian force that people hate. They have resorted to this more, you know, they used to rely on people's love, now they rely on people's fear. But the problem with that is that when the Shia community, and it's happening, becomes against Hezbollah and is afraid of Hezbollah instead of being, you know, part of Hezbollah's state, this is the main issue. Because if you think about it, Hezbollah's political power in Lebanon is based on three pillars. One is the Shia community. They need them for, you know, to recruit soldiers, but also for votes. Without the Shia community, they cannot represent the Shia. Second, their political allies. And after 2019 protests, their political allies have really lost a lot. You know, people, their political allies are the most corrupt. And if you think about it, if Hezbollah wants to look around today, if it's a little bit of birri, but, you know, their Christian allies are dead, you know, like losing the game completely. And the other allies in the Druze community and the Sunni community are very small. So this is another pillar that is weakening. The third ally is their weapons. And they know today their weapons are weak because they do have weapons. But Iran is not in a position to send them more weapons if they lose them. So they know if they use them, they lose them. So the threat of their arms today is much more efficient than their arms. They can use their arms to do this stuff, killing people inside Lebanon, assassinations, little violence here and there. But a war with Israel is very risky now, because if they use their arms, they will lose them, and they are expiring every day. And Israel is already, as we speak, hitting their weapon factories and weapon depots in Syria every day. So this is another pillar that is not really doing well. So when all these pillars shake, and if the international community look at Hezbollah through these pillars, and they really go decide to target these pillars as they shake, Hezbollah's fall would be faster. But it's important to actually, for the whole of international community, especially Europe, to look at these three pillars and do something about it. Because so far, Hezbollah's allies have only been sanctioned by the U.S., which really shook them, but not enough for them to fall. If Europe sanctions Hezbollah's allies, the corrupt politicians, that would be a big deal. If their weapons are targeted in a way that is exposed, also it's a big deal. And the Shia community need alternatives other than Hezbollah. And everyone in the international community need to understand this. Hezbollah should not be the only alternative for the Shia community. And they don't want them to be the only alternative. So, but somebody needs to realize this. And that would be my policy to fight Hezbollah in Lebanon. Why do you wait for Iran to change?
The Irish government, as you know, it's just concluding its temporary membership of the United Nations Security Council. But Ireland is often, described as a diplomatic superpower because of our connections around the world and our maybe influence on international security. I don't get a sense that the Irish government are going to press for any significant action against Hezbollah.
That'd be a mistake.
Over this, you would believe that's a mistake?
I think that'd be a mistake. That's exactly why Hezbollah targeted an Irish soldier.
And when you say that, you would believe maybe that it would be more appropriate for Ireland to lead efforts within the European Union to actually sanction Hezbollah. That would be far more...
Absolutely. That's how you fight this. That's how you protect yourself. Because if you don't go there, if you really decide to just like let it go, you're empowering Hezbollah and you're basically giving them what they want. And that the message has been received and everybody will go back to what they do and Hezbollah gets what they want. But fighting back is the only way to actually teach them a lesson and hold them accountable. Without accountability, really, like nothing's going to change. Not just in Lebanon, everywhere. Everywhere. This is all spilling out to the rest of the world. And it's not just, you know, like a Lebanese problem. Hezbollah is an international problem. Their terrorism is actually outside Lebanon, more than Lebanon. So it's a mistake to just let them be. They have to be held accountable.
I see. Haleen, thank you so much for joining us today. And thank you for your excellent analysis of
this
very difficult.
Thank you for having me. It's definitely my pleasure. This is a very important topic for both the Lebanese and the Irish people. And it's my pleasure to talk about it with you.
Okay, you've been listening to Hanan Gadar of the Washington Institute. I would like to thank her for joining us to discuss this awful tragedy. I will be broadcasting a really interesting podcast next week featuring Dr. Joan Donovan of Harvard University, who will be discussing disinformation. And finally, before I go, could I take this opportunity to wish you all a very happy Christmas. Until we speak again, do take care.